Mecca, Sunday, February 16th, 2014. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's Tom for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast after a slightly unplanned hiatus. Glad to be back here with you talking about all things Apple and Macintosh, and we've got tons of things to talk about this week. Lots of stuff going on. Latest on any of the iWatch rumors, some updates on what's happening with Apple's Sapphire Glass plant, a little bit of a change from at least one analyst in predictions on the 12-inch iPad, and also those of you down under now have a new way to listen to some iTunes music. So we're going to talk about all of that and get to some hints and tips and tricks and all of your feedback. But before we do that, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Sanebox. You know, I do not know how I survived without Sanebox. Now, having had it, having used it, it's something that I've come to completely rely on. And this is something David Sparks mentioned in his email book. That's where one of the places I first heard about Sanebox. And what the deal is that we all get tons of email, right? And you've got to prioritize and organize and manage all that stuff. And it can be a hassle. And that's really where Sanebox comes in. It's like a preprocessor for your email. It will automatically go through and clean up your mailbox, moving your sort of less important emails out of the way so that you can focus on really the stuff that you need to get to right away and then kind of come back and grab the other stuff later. It basically gives you what I'm calling an inbox-less inbox, which allows you to get to inbox zero, something that I strive to achieve with my emails. So, for example, my inbox, when I used to jump into it, had hundreds of messages every day and really only maybe a few dozen important ones like your feedback emails, things like that. All the other stuff was PR and newsletters and order receipts and registrations, all still important stuff, stuff that I want to get to, but it doesn't need to be crammed there in my inbox. It can be shuffled off, put someplace else, and I can come back and grab that stuff later. And that's exactly what Sanebox does. And best of all, it works everywhere on any email account, client, or device that you have. All you do is tell it about the accounts you have. It sets up some additional mailboxes, some Sanebox mailboxes to work with your inbox, and then it watches what you do with your email to train itself. You don't have to do a lot of setup or configuration. It's going to figure out what's important to you, looking at what you open, what you respond to, how quickly, how often, all those sorts of factors, and then it'll start shuffling things off. And if it puts something in the wrong place, you just drag it to the place you want it, and Sanebox will remember all of that stuff. So the training is super easy, and you can fix the mistakes quickly and easily. It has a lot of other features, too much to tell you about. Things like one-click unsubscriber, snoozing non-urgent emails so that they come back into your inbox if you need to get to them later, moving attachments to online storage services like Dropbox, all really great stuff. And you can check it out and get all the information by going to sanebox.com/Maccast. And best of all, you can try it free and get a $10 credit by using that URL. So go to sanebox.com/Maccast. You're going to get a $10 credit. You can get a free trial, sign up. Awesome, awesome service. I highly recommend it. And a big thank you to Sanebox for their support of the MacCast. Kicking off the news for this week, there is an issue that Apple acknowledged this past week that may impact some of you. Apple recently acknowledged an AirPlay issue impacting the latest MacBook Pros and Mac Pros. Those are the late 2013 models. In a support article, they detailed the issue where AirPlay mirroring performance could freeze or even drop out in some instances. But here's the strange thing. It only impacts Macs, if you are using 802.11b or g networks. So they've detailed the fix in this support article, but basically it's to disable Bluetooth on your Mac. obviously not an ideal thing if you're using a Magic Mouse, a trackpad, or an Apple wireless keyboard, right? You're going to have to go back to an old wired keyboard and mouse if you have that lying around. I think a better fix would be probably to upgrade your network to 802.11, or better yet, 802.11ac. So if you have an older router that's only running BG and you're using that with your new MacBook Pro or your new Mac Pro, you probably want to get one of the dual band routers if you need to run the older technology. But I'm assuming if you're the owner of a 2013 MacBook Pro or a Mac Pro, you're probably the kind of person that likes to live on the cutting edge, and you probably could do with a Wi-Fi upgrade. But if that thing did impact you, if you have one of those new models, you've been noticing some issues with your AirPlay performance, you might check your network and make sure that you're running, you know, the latest standards. And if not, then disable your Bluetooth, I guess. I don't know what you think, but I think the iWatch rumors are moving from simply just rumors into the realm of potentially entirely plausible possibility. is that a good way to put it? It's looking more and more like Apple's wearable device, whether you call it an iWatch or not, is going to become a real product very likely sometime this year, at least if the volume of reports and sort of frequency and cross-corroboration of the reports is to be believed. It's also looking pretty clear, if you look at many of Apple's recent hires, that the device is going to be much more than just simply a watch. Sensors and sensor technology are likely the key to the whole thing, but the exact functions and technology that is going to be in the device, that's really still all, you know, wrapped up in rumor, and we'll have to wait until launch probably to figure out what's going to be clear. There's sort of on again, off again rumors about different specific functions and things like that. But that's not going to stop us, of course, from speculating on what might be happening. Apple has been hiring just a ton of people in the sensor and medical technology fields. And so it's pretty fair to assume that an iWatch is going to have a serious focus, I think, on health and fitness monitoring and tracking, among other things. As far as what kind of fitness and health tracking might be in there, well, we've heard the usual kind of stuff, things like pedometers to track your steps, weight and calorie counting, sleep tracking, those sorts of things. And Apple's hired some people in those kinds of fields. But we've also heard about some more advanced kind of sensor technology, things like pulse and heart rate monitoring, even going so far as doing maybe something like blood glucose monitoring. And those more advanced features are rumored to possibly not be making it into the 1.0 version of the project. But Apple definitely has people in those fields and in those areas that they've hired, so it's safe to assume they're looking into and exploring those kinds of technologies for some sort of product, and the logical conclusion would be some sort of wearable device. Whether that's all rolled up in the same thing, that remains to be seen. But something that's definitely going to be needed in that kind of product is going to be some sort of serious battery. The more sensors and technology you load in there, the more battery drain is going to be required on the device. And even with low energy Bluetooth, those sorts of things, Apple's going to have to figure some stuff out. What we heard this week from the Korea Herald is that some of the new battery tech may be supplied by companies like Samsung, Taiyuan Lithium Battery, if I'm saying that right, and LG Chem. And the key to the longer battery life in that tiny of a device may be a technology called stepped battery technology, which is something apparently LG Chem has designs for. And I thought this was going to be some sort of power stepping, like, you know, alternating the power on and off. But no, it's actually more literal than that. It sounds exactly like what it is. It's a ridge or a step in the actual shape of the battery that reportedly can boost the battery's lifespan by about 16%. And stepped batteries can also be apparently shaped into curves so that it could, say, wrap around a wrist in a watch-like device. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, like I did, well, 16% more battery, that doesn't sound like a huge difference. But then I started thinking, well, that could mean the difference at the end of the day between having 34% battery life left or 50%. And if you're like me, 50% is a much more comfortable place to be in. Now, we've heard reports that Apple has some prototypes that were maybe just getting 2 days of battery life, and that was really something Apple wasn't happy with. So it makes sense that they would be looking into newer and more improved battery technologies. There was also a rumor for a while that Apple was investigating solar as a possible way to help extend the battery life. Those rumors are a little bit iffy, and it seems like Apple might not be doing it. And they're exploring that technology, I guess is what we can assume. But whether or not it'll actually make it into the first generation device is looking unlikely. They also are supposedly looking into wireless induction charging, something that I think would be great in a watch-style product, being able to just set it down and actually have it charge. I have a Pebble, and one of my biggest complaints is the little charging cable that it comes with. One, it's proprietary and specialized. It has magnets, so it kind of works like a MagSafe connector, but it doesn't stay on very well. I have trouble with it, and it's just a big pain and a hassle. So I think for ease of use, induction charging really does make sense. Apple's also hired some of the top managers and designers from different sports and fashion industry-based companies, so I think it's likely that an iWatch product is not only going to be highly functional, but it's going to look good too. I guess that could be a subjective thing, but Apple has a pretty good history at making some pretty nice-looking products. And Tim Cook recently told the Wall Street Journal that Apple is hard at work on products that would be considered to be in new product categories for the company. So I think a wearable device definitely fits into that. A new television product also might be falling into that realm. And Cook did promise that they are continuing to also drive Mac development forward. So Apple hasn't given up on Macs or devices just yet. That's good news, something that a lot of people wanted to hear. So that's the latest on the iWatch. What about Apple's next generation iPhone, the iPhone 6? Well, we have some updates and new rumors there. One is that production of the Touch ID fingerprint sensor in the next iPhone will remain identical to the current model, the iPhone 5S. Now, TSMC was said to be investigating a 12-inch processing method for Touch ID sensors in the next phone, but surprise, surprise, guess what? They're having yield issues. I think we've heard this one before. And Apple has said, nope, we're going to go back. We're going to use the existing process for the next phone. That means they're going to be using a proven production method. They're going to be able to keep yield rates up, something that they're probably going to want when they're releasing a new version of the phone. Sony is reportedly going to be supplying both the front and back camera modules for the iPhone 6. No details or specs on how the modules might change. Sony has been a major supplier for Apple in the past, although I don't know if they've exclusively provided both sensors. Tim Cook also said in an interview that Apple was not opposed to the idea of larger screen iPhones, but again noted as he has in the past that Apple won't make compromises just to make a larger screen happen. We're still hearing rumors that the next generation devices may have a screen between 4.7 and 5.5 inches. It's also being rumored that it will have a higher pixel density. As a matter of fact, I recently saw one report saying it could be as high as 441 pixels per inch. And finally, we're also hearing that the iPhone 5C might not be long for the world after the release of the iPhone 6, with the iPhone 5S sliding down to take its place as the mid-priced iPhone. And so when will we be able to get our hands on the 6, and when will the iPhone 5C maybe meet its demise? Well, all the recent rumors seem to be putting the time frame around September of this year. I think that makes a lot of sense. We had heard some reports trying to say Apple might come out with a model earlier than that. I think Apple's going to stick to their fall release cycle, September, October, around the time frame when we'll see that new iPhone. And one other thing we had been hearing a lot about with regard to the new iPhone 5/6 is that it might not use Corning's Gorilla Glass anymore, that Apple may be looking to replace that in favor of Sapphire Glass. One concern, though, is how Apple would be able to get enough glass at a good enough price to cover the faces of so many millions of iPhones. Well, one analyst this week uncovered documents that show Apple's Sapphire Glass partner in Arizona, GT Advanced, has been purchasing enough furnaces to produce between 103 million to 116 million 5-inch displays per year. So that would significantly go to meet some of Apple's requirements if they wanted to encase their new iPhone in Sapphire. They also reportedly have another 420 machines on order, so they could potentially double that output. Some have said that Apple wouldn't use the glass for iPhones, but rather use it for its iWatch project. Now hearing the numbers, hearing the kinds of volume they could potentially crank out at that plant, I'm thinking, how could they use that much production just for an iWatch? It's looking to me more like this may be a strategy Apple's taking for the next generation iPhone. Or heck, maybe they're just trying to create one facility where that can supply all of the Sapphire Glass that they would need for just about every device and product that they have. Apple does already use Sapphire Glass to cover the lenses on iPhones and iPads, and also to cover their Touch ID sensors. So all of their needs could be met, I think, by this one facility. Now, one thing I had read is that Sapphire might be a little bit more breakable than Gorilla Glass, the Gorilla Glass that Apple currently uses. So I would be concerned about that, because historically, Apple devices are pretty breakable when it comes to the glass screens and things like that. Maybe they've worked out some other kinds of technology that can be combined with Sapphire to better protect it from breakage. The one thing about Sapphire, though, is it's reportedly extremely, extremely scratch resistant. I think one reason why it's great for camera lenses. So there was a video out this week where I think they showed taking a concrete block and sliding a back and forth across a piece of Sapphire glass, and nothing happened to it. It was crystal clear after that. So would add a lot to the scratch resistance. Although I have to admit, whatever glass is on my iPhone 5S, I think that's Gorilla Glass 3, it has been incredibly resilient also to scratching. So if they can find that balance between scratch and crack protection, then I think they have a home run on their hands. They're obviously investing a lot into it and think that Sapphire in some way is going to be the future of glass in Apple products. One of the ways that you can ensure that your Apple devices, iOS devices, charge and sync properly is by making sure that you buy only made for iPhone or made for iOS cables, ones that are certified by Apple to have the proper connectors and to be made properly by certified partners. Well, one of the disadvantages of that has historically been that those cables tend to be more expensive. There's a lot of third-party non-certified cables out there that are a lot cheaper, but they pose the risks of, one, maybe just not even working, two, being potentially harmful or damaging your devices, depending upon how they were manufactured. Well, Apple may have made a small step to getting the cost of certified Lightning cables to come down a bit. Apple reportedly quietly scaled back the licensing fees it's charging to companies who want to make Lightning or made-for-eye accessories. Now, we don't know exactly how much lower, just that it is lower. The existing fees were said to be somewhere in the range of $4 US per connector, and could be up to double that if the vendor needed to do pass-through. But the result of the change could mean that we see lower-priced third-party Lightning cables and accessories that are Apple-certified. So that's a good thing for us. Another key component of Apple's Made for Eye program was that suppliers need to have their factories comply with some of Apple's supplier code of conduct policies, and this week Apple did issue their 2013 supplier responsibility report. It's available on Apple's website if you want to browse through it. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But a couple highlights I wanted to point out: Apple ran 51% more audits this year, so they're checking up on factories more frequently, and that seems to have resulted in a lot more compliance. They've also tightened up their environmental controls when it comes to dumping hazardous chemicals and waste disposal things like that. So that's a nice improvement. And they are also still one of the few technology companies to fully disclose their entire supplier list on their website. So it shows their suppliers and the products that they produce for Apple. And that's a good thing because watchdog groups and groups outside of Apple can kind of monitor and keep track of who Apple's partnering with and making sure that they stay in compliance. And as a matter of fact, Greenpeace, who called Apple one of the worst tech companies when it comes to the environment in 2009, applauded Apple this week for taking steps to cut conflict minerals from their products. Those are minerals mined from areas that are in conflict or going through war, things like that. And also for their supply chain, for that supply chain transparency that I mentioned earlier, saying that Samsung and others should follow Apple's example. So that's a huge turnaround in terms of Greenpeace's view of Apple. And I think it's really great to see Apple under Tim Cook really leading the charge in a lot of these areas and leading by example, you know, their environmental stance, all of those other things, their human rights stance, being much more open and public about those efforts, I think is a good thing for Apple. And it's one of those examples when I talked about way back when of Tim Cook, feeling that Tim Cook was going to step out and really run Apple as Tim Cook's Apple, and that ultimately that could be a really good thing. A lot of people were concerned about that. I think so far he's done an excellent job in many of the areas improving the products, even though some people have been critical of that, but also in all of these other efforts. And I think it's great that we can turn around and applaud Apple for that from time to time. The rumor mill giveth and the rumor mill taketh away, at least when it comes to a 12-inch iPad Pro. He does say that Apple is focusing on a new 12.9-inch iPad for the tablet market this year, but thinks that the iPad Air will actually be the only iPad model to see a refresh at least in 2014. He says that the new iPad Air will get a bump in the processor up to a next generation A8 and also add Apple's Touch ID fingerprint sensor technology, and expects that to happen sometime in the third quarter of this year. But he doesn't think that the rumored iPad Pro, the larger 12.9-inch iPad, will be ready before the close of 2014. Surprisingly, he also doesn't think that an iPad mini refresh will happen this year, and as such, he thinks that iPad shipments will actually decline this year just slightly. He also says that Apple will retire sales of the iPad 2. And while he doesn't say it directly, he did mention that possibly Apple might be bringing back the fourth generation iPad with Retina display. I guess that could be the one that would replace the iPad 2 as the lower priced offering. Now, historically, Ming Chai has been pretty good with his Apple rumors, so I tend to take his stuff with a little bit larger grain of salt. As far as 12-inch devices go, then, this next one might make some of you happy. He also claims that Apple is planning to release a new ultra-slim 12-inch Retina MacBook Pro sometime in the middle of 2014. So, makes me kind of wonder if some of the screen rumors that we've been hearing about a 12.9-inch screen or an 11-inch screen for a next-generation iPad may actually have been rumors for a new Retina-based MacBook Pro coming into the lineup. What's interesting, though, is would that 12-inch model actually replace the 13-inch? I remember that the 12-inch form factor was one of the most popular form factors of the MacBook Pro back in the day when Apple had a 12-inch offering. A lot of people really, really loved that size and form factor. It wouldn't be that far off of a 13-inch model and would be closer in size to the 11-inch MacBook Air, which is also extremely, extremely popular in terms of form factor. So might be a little bit better balanced between 12 and 15, kind of give a bigger distinction between the two devices and their uses, and could be a cool new addition to Apple's lineup if you're a fan of that 12-inch form factor. The folks over at Bare Feet have their hands on the new Mac Pro, and they've been doing what they do best, pushing the thing to its limits. And more recently, they turned their attention to those dual GPUs that are in that model. They figured out that the new dual GPUs can actually be connected together in what AMD calls a crossfire mode. Basically, what this does is it allows the two cards to be connected together, significantly boosting the performance of geometry-limited applications. What that means, from what I'm reading, is that the two cards will show up as a single smokin GPU to the operating system. So that means that you can actually jump up the performance of your applications without the apps needing to be rewritten to take advantage of dual cards. So what that translates to is being able to take your existing applications, say a game that's not written for dual GPUs, and actually run it and bump up things like the graphics and the frame rate. And it also could boost things like CAD applications or anything that would be designed to maximize the GPU. It's going to see it as one GPU, and then I would assume the Crossfire technology is handling doling out to the different processors based on load. I didn't dive too deep into it, but that kind of sounds what it's like. So this sounds awesome, right? We can fully just crank out stuff on new applications. We won't have one of those graphics cards sitting there idle like we do with current applications. Yeah, it sounds awesome until you hear the downside. There's always a downside, right? The downside is, at least for now, this trick only seems to work when you're booted into Windows using Boot Camp. So the ball's in Apple's court now to add support for the Crossfire technology. The one hang-up from the reports that I'm reading is that Apple generally doesn't want to be exclusive to a single GPU manufacturer like AMD. So the technology, this Crossfire technology, I guess is proprietary by vendor. And because Apple won't lock themselves in, they may not add this kind of support within the operating system. Or I'm assuming there's also probably a hardware component to it. So they don't want to lock it in on the hardware or the software. What do you think? You think that's the direction Apple's going? Does this kind of thing even matter to you? I think for a lot of people, especially that are in that Mac Pro target market, this could be a huge boost, because otherwise they're going to have to wait around for that new version to come out and hope that their favorite software manufacturer for whatever they're doing actually adds dual GPU support. And this would be a good end run, a way to get around that and to boost the performance of their existing software and applications. Apple has finally rolled their iTunes radio service outside the US, and if you are an Australian listener, you are the beneficiary. On Monday, Apple launched iTunes radio in Australia. It's the first country outside the US to get the service, and they are offering both the free ad-supported edition on Macs and on iOS 7. And if you pay the Aussie dollar $35.99 a year subscription price for iTunes Match, you will get the service ad-free. Now, apparently, there was a soft rollout of the iTunes radio service in Australia, but also Canada and the UK. That was late last month, but so far, Australia is the only new country outside the US to get an official rollout. As far as I've heard, things are pretty much the same in the service as in the US, and I assume that it's tweaked slightly to match more local interests and bands, things like that, the tastes of the local region, along with the sort of artists and featured artists, those sorts of things being more geared toward Australia and the Australian service versus the US. But of course, I haven't seen it, because I live here. So if you happen to live down under and you're a Maccaster, let us know what you think of the new iTunes radio. Let us know how it's working out for you. I'd love to hear from you, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the news for this week, we have more evidence that an Apple TV update might be coming soon. 9to5 Mac has found references to a new model of Apple TV hardware within the latest iOS 7 software builds. There is an Apple TV 4.1 reference in there, and the last tweak to the Apple TV 3, changed the reference from 3.1 to 3.2. That was a minor update of the Apple TV hardware, so it's logical that a 4.1 update would be assumed to be a significant change in the hardware. It's believed that one of the big additions to a next-generation Apple TV would be the addition of support for games, along with Bluetooth game controller support that would, in essence, turn your Apple TV set-top box into a mini gaming console, something that a lot of people are excited about. We've talked about it a little bit here on the MacCast. Apple has also been working on expanding their channel content on the device. Recently, they added a Beatles channel, which shows the original U.S. appearance of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And we've been hearing reports that Apple's been in talk with cable companies to try and acquire more content for the device. Apparently, they've given up on trying to work directly with the studios to get the content and are going to cable providers to provide specifically more live content, live channels for the device. To me, it seems a little bit like an unholy alliance, because the whole point of the Apple TV in my mind is actually for people who want to be cable or cord cutters, right? We want to get away from the cable TV companies, and this is just tying it more closely to the cable TV companies. It's going to be more and more of those channels that require you to authorize with an already paid TV subscription, something that I think a lot of us don't want. But I think the thing that's pushing Apple in that direction is that, at least temporarily, they need to gain more traction for the Apple TV. And this is a way to attract more consumers, to make the product more relevant in a lot of consumers' minds. And I think cable cutters are still, or cord cutters are still, a minority compared to the other kinds of TV consumers. And so for now, it may be okay for Apple to move forward with that strategy. Getting more content means more visibility, means more people purchasing those products. And once they have more people on the platform, then they can kind of sell it into other venues. I'd really like to see them going after more exclusive content, more content that is created directly by content creators and then sold directly. I really think long term, the future of Apple TV is going to be an app store or an iBook store or an iBook store style model, where it's a lot of self-published content. It's content creators creating the content, producing it, and then Apple just taking a small cut for the sale and distribution portion of it. And Apple has so many screens out there, I think they really could leverage that, but maybe they think they need more, specifically on the Apple TV environment. There's also many people that are really hoping that Apple's going to be bringing applications, full-blown applications, like on other iOS devices, to the Apple TV. I don't think we're quite there yet. I think games is going to be the first foray into apps on the Apple TV that are outside the content space. And then slowly they might roll in specific apps. I could see things like weather apps or maybe some news apps, news reading apps coming to the device and then expanding out from there. But Bloomberg says that Apple is getting set to unveil the device sometime around the April timeframe. But then they also said that it wouldn't be available for sale until the holidays, till around Christmas time. That seems like way too long lead time for me, for Apple. Apple typically doesn't tip its hand like that and announce a product. I guess we could see them showing off maybe an SDK or some information to developers at WWDC and then releasing something in the fall. That timeline might make sense. April just seems a little bit too early. Maybe June, July for some sort of announcement, and then following up with a release sometime in the fall. With that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Lynda.com. You know, Lynda.com, they're a site that offers high-quality video courses to anyone who wants to learn creative software or other kinds of business skills. They have over 2,000 different courses, with new courses being added all the time. As a matter of fact, I was just browsing on there. You know, as a web developer and programmer, I like to go on and look for new courses to maybe update some of my skills. My technology is always changing. There's new platforms coming on board. There's new, like, JavaScript libraries, things that I need to learn. And Lynda.com has been a great resource for me. I can search quickly for the kind of thing that I'm looking for. So say I want to find out about that latest Java framework. I can search, find out if they have a course. Boom, I'm there, and I can jump in and start watching. If you've ever wanted to learn programming on an iOS, I think it's a great place to start. A lot of people have asked me, how do I get started with iOS programming? And there's books and things like that, but Lynda.com is a good place to check out. As a matter of fact, I was recently searching through there. They have a bunch of Foundation of Programming courses. These are great because they're going to cover core concepts, things like design patterns, code efficiency, just the basics of programming. And then from there, you can jump into some of the starter courses on programming and coding, specifically for iOS. They have an Objective-C essential training course. They have an up and running with iOS SDK course. And I saw Xcode 5 and iOS 7 SDK new feature courses. So that'll get you up to speed on a lot of the tools and the SDKs that you're going to need, as well as get you started with Objective-C programming. And that's just the start. From there, you can go on and browse all the different courses, and you can kind of move up the chain as you gain more and more skills. They're going to have a new course for you that's going to meet your ever-expanding skill set. So I really want you to check it out, and we have a deal for you. You can get a free trial access to the entire library. That's going to let you get access to everything so you can see for yourself what I'm talking about. And when you're ready to sign up, they have full access plans starting at as low as $25 a month. It's a really good deal. And they also offer gift subscriptions. So it's a great gift for a student or a family member, someone looking to gain a new skill or extend their existing skills. Just head to lynda.com/MacCast. There you'll find out all the details on the offer. You can see the different kinds of services and different plans that they offer. That's lynda.com, lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to them for their support of the show. If you're running Mail in OS X Mavericks, then you've probably noticed a few little bugs. I've heard about some people having issues, and I'm saying that very tongue-in-cheek because Mail has reportedly been very buggy for a lot of folks in OS X Mavericks. Now, some people are having no issues whatsoever. Some are having some really bad issues. But one bug that you may have noticed is that Mail is not being picked up after the initial opening of the application. So you open it up, it goes out, it checks all your new messages, pulls those in. But if you sit there and leave it open, it's not pulling in additional messages. And if you've experienced that, well, you're not alone. Now, luckily, Cult of Mac posted some help for us, and I thought I'd let you know how that works. Basically, to get things unstuck, normally what you'd do is you'd have to completely quit Mail and then relaunch it again. But what Cult of Mac discovered is that you can get things unstuck without having to relaunch. If you go into the Mailbox menu and you choose Take All Accounts Offline, and then in the same menu, choose Get All New Mail. It sounds counterintuitive, I know, but that apparently will enable it to go back out and get your new mail messages without having to reboot. And they point out, to make it even more convenient, what you can do is you can customize the toolbar menu. So go up under the View menu, hit Customize Toolbar, and you can actually add buttons to the toolbar for taking the accounts offline and for getting the new mail. So put those right there, and when you need to check your mail, just tap the two and you won't have to restart. Now, hopefully you won't be having to use this workaround too much longer, because Apple does have OS X 10.9.2 on its sixth beta version. It's out to developers, so they're getting pretty far along in the update process, and hopefully that will have a fix for a lot of the mail problems a lot of you have been having. But I wanted to point that one out. I know there's some other ones out there, so if you have run into a mail issue in Mavericks, and more specifically, if you have a workaround, be sure to let us know about it. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Received an email from Adrian this week. He's actually a switcher, and he's loving his new Mac experience. But one thing that he was curious about was how to get the trash to empty without having to take multiple steps. Specifically, what he was asking about was, he says, you know, I use USB sticks to transfer a lot of my files and data around, but when I delete files from the USB stick, basically selecting them in the Finder and hitting delete, as you know, all that does is move those files to the trash. And if you don't empty the trash, they stay in there. They still are technically on that flash drive. And Adrian points out, on Windows, if you do that, it actually just deletes them directly. So he prefers that kind of behavior, because then he doesn't have to actually empty the trash to be able to get that data back and reuse it. So he was wondering, is there a way to enable that kind of functionality in OS X without actually having to go into something like Disk Utility and completely reformat the USB stick, or actually go up and do a second step to actually empty the trash? Well, I did some quick Googling for you, Adrian, and I found a couple different solutions. There were a few applications out there. There was one called Delete Files Without Using Trash from a company called Blazing Tools. And what it does is basically add a delete and a delete as administrator option to your contextual menu in the Finder. So if you control click or right click on a set of files or a folder or something like that, you'll be able to delete them directly. Now, to install it in Mountain Lion and Mavericks, they note that you need to completely disable the gatekeeper functionality. The typical right-click and choose open doesn't seem to work, which seemed a little bit suspect to me. So personally, I wouldn't use it, but I wanted to point the tool out there because it is out there. There was also a GitHub project that is a service called Delete Immediately. And what that does is adds a service to the services menu on your Mac that will allow you to do the delete in one step. Now, this may be a little bit trickier for some folks to set up, but once it's installed, basically you go again in the Finder, right click or control click on the items you want to delete, then just go under the services menu in the contextual menu and you'll find the delete immediately option. You could also use the services menu from the Apple menu, I would assume, as well. But that's how that works. Now, all of these solutions, I believe, you know, without actually being able to get into the source code, but I believe are essentially relying on the remove functionality or the remove command that's built into Unix, which underlies Mac OS X. There's an rm command that you can run in the terminal that would actually do exactly the same thing. So thinking about this, I would prefer to kind of roll my own solution. And luckily, it's fairly easy to do if you're more than moderately comfortable digging into the terminal a little bit or digging into Automator, AppleScript, that sort of thing. So let me let you know how you can actually do this. If you wanted to just use the terminal, you could go into Applications Utilities Terminal each time you wanted to delete something. It's a little more manual, but then you could just use the rm command to delete the files that you want. Now, big warning to anybody who is going to hear these instructions. Using the rm command, the remove command in the terminal, basically tells the system to delete your files and folders immediately without any kind of warning, without any kind of prompting. And if you get the path wrong, you could be ending up deleting something you didn't mean to delete. So using this command incorrectly can have catastrophic results. Needless to say, have backups and also be very sure about the paths and the files and things that you are wanting to delete. Now, there's a little trick you can use to make it a little more accurate and avoid a few errors. So launch the terminal, Applications Utilities Terminal, and then in the terminal window, type the command rm space dash rf. And then put a space on the end of it, but don't hit enter, don't do anything yet. Then drag the files or folders into the terminal window from the Finder that you want to remove. So just drag them from the Finder, and what that's going to do is automatically insert the full path to those files or that file or folder. Once you have that path in there, double check it, make sure it's exactly what you want to delete, and then hit enter, and those files and folders will be removed instantly. They're not going to go to the trash. They're just going to be gone from your system. Now, because there's no checks and balances in there, I think a better way to do this would be to build your own service using Automator. And I found a great thread on Stack Exchange, on the Apple Stack Exchange, that explains how to do it. I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. But with this method, we can add a little confirm step into the process to help reduce any errors. So you're going to want to launch Automator. So just go into Applications, Automator, launch Automator. And then when the project panel comes up, choose a service project as the type of project that you want to build. It's one of the options in there, services, basically. And you pick that document type, and it's going to open up the main Automator interface. And in the top right panel, at the very top of the new workflow, you want to set the service receives selected option to files and folders, telling it you're going to pass files and folders to the service, and you want it to work in the Finder. So that's the next option over. For under in, choose Finder. And then once you've set that up, you're going to want to add your first action to the Automator actions. And the first one we're going to add is ask for confirmation. So over on the left, you can search for it, or you can just find it in the list there. There's an ask for confirmation action. Drag that into the main area of the workflow, and that's going to be your first step. And in there, then you can set a message that you want to appear, something like, are you sure, or please confirm you want to delete these files, or whatever you want it to say. And there's also a cancel and okay button that are automatically inserted. You can actually change the labels on those too. So if you want to get creative with this, with what your dialogue says, feel free to have fun. But put in some sort of message confirming that you want to actually delete the files and folders. Then the next action that you're going to add is going to be run shell script. So find the run shell script action, drag that in right under your ask for confirmation action. And set the pass input option to as arguments, basically saying we're going to take the files and folders as an argument and we're going to pass them into this shell script. This is going to set up a little block of shell script code for you, and you're going to see a for loop and a do action, as well as some variables in there. There's going to be an input variable and some other variables. And then inside the do section, you'll have a little echo command. You want to change the echo part to the remove command that I mentioned earlier. So it's going to be rm-rf. And you can leave the string f variable in place, because that's going to be the files and folders that are going to get passed in. As a bonus, and you'll see this in the Stack Exchange article, you can actually, after the done part of the script, you can add an af play command. Basically what this does is it plays an audio file from your Mac. So if you want to play that little empty trash sound, can actually do that. You put in the AF play command and then pass it the full path to the sound file that you want to play. In the case of the trash sound, that can be found in the main system library folder inside components. You'll find a core audio component folder inside that, contents, shared support, system sounds, finder, and emptytrash.aif. So AIFF file format is probably the file format you want to go with for an Automator action. So that's just a little add-on. It's not necessary for the workflow. But once you've got that all set up, you're going to finish it by saving the Automator action. Give it whatever name you want to appear in the services menu in the Finder. So something like trash immediately or delete immediately seems appropriate. And once you've done that, you can now select files or folders in the Finder and then right click or control click on them and go under the services menu, and you should see that new service that you set up. So in my case, I named mine trash immediately. So now in the Finder under the services menu, I see a trash immediately option. And when I choose that, a little dialogue pops up, asks me to confirm that I want to delete those files. If I hit okay, then it will actually delete it. If I hit cancel, it'll leave them in place. And so once you've set up your service, you probably want to set up a couple dummy files, just create some blank folders or some quick text files, and just use the action confirm it does exactly what you want it to do. And once you've confirmed that it's working, everything like that, you can also add a keyboard shortcut for it if you'd like by going into System Preferences Keyboard and clicking on the keyboard shortcut tab, go under the services section, and you can assign a keyboard shortcut to your new service. So hopefully that gives you kind of the functionality you want, Adrian. I know it's not just as simple as dragging the files, you know, into the trash and having them delete immediately, but it should serve your needs, I think. Joe emailed me recently to let me know that he is in charge of a new club and he is looking for a database to kind of help him manage it. And typically when someone's looking for a database, a personal database or database for a small organization, something like that, and they don't have a lot of money to spend, the answer had always been Bento from FileMaker. Well, Bento is dead. And so Joe was asking, you know, with Bento no longer around, what are my options for a personal database? And the seemingly obvious solution would be, well, just upgrade to Bento's bigger brother, FileMaker, right? But the problem is, as Joe rightly points out, the cost. FileMaker Pro or FileMaker will cost you over $300 US just to even get into. And that's probably more than most people want to spend just for a little database to run their club. They do offer the ability to transition your old Bento stuff over into FileMaker, and there's a ton of other features and functionality, but a lot of it is probably overkill for most of these uses. So the question is, what are our options for consumer-level databases on the Mac that aren't Bento? And I had no idea. I hadn't looked into this. I had a copy of Bento. I still do. I think it's a great product, and I was really sad to see FileMaker kill it off. But, you know, what are our options? So a quick little searching around, I found three different ones you might want to check out. Most of them came through an article over at Macworld. There's one called iDatabase that's $20, $19.99 US from AppyMac. There is Symphatum that is $7 US from geosys.com, and TapForms for Mac, that's $29 US from TapForms.com. Now, I haven't tried or used any of these applications, but in the Macworld write-up, it seemed like TapForms was kind of the most capable of all of them. It still, though, falls short, according to their report, of a full Bento replacement, although the newest version of TapForms does seem to have a decent import feature for some of the old Bento templates and also has support for some relational data. So if you need those kinds of features, that seemed to be the one. The other ones, especially iDatabase or Symphatum, seemed a little bit more slimmed down and just simple and basic. So I don't know if those are going to meet your needs, Joe. Maybe some of you in the community can help Joe out. If you've tried any of these applications as a Bento replacement, let us know and I can kind of pass the email along to Joe. I'd be curious myself to know what people are using for this kind of application. But myself, being a web developer and programmer, if you're a little more technically inclined and a little more savvy about web development and programming, you might consider using MySQL or a SQLite database. MySQL Community Server runs on the Mac. It's free. They have a binary installer at the MySQL website, and they even have a MySQL system preference pane to be able to start and stop the MySQL service. And there's a lot of cheap or free graphic user interface tools for managing MySQL databases. So basically, you can get a table view form to kind of set up your database. Now, if you need more of the Bento style form interface part of it, well, then you probably need to run Apache web server and kind of set things up and build a little web interface, maybe using PHP or Python, JavaScript, something like that, those kinds of tools to help you interface and just input and manage the data in a more kind of human way if you don't want to be in that kind of spreadsheet table mode with some of the direct MySQL or SQLite GUI tools. And if you need to set up like Apache Server, that's built into OS X, but there's a great program called MAMP that will allow you to do that with a GUI as well. So you can kind of make it a little bit easier on yourself, but still at the end of the day, that kind of solution is going to be a little more advanced to kind of set up and manage. Now, SQLite is also built into OS X and pretty easy to work with. There's a great application that I really like for managing SQLite databases called Base. It is £19.99 about $34 US, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But again, with that kind of solution, you're going to need to build your own GUI using PHP, JavaScript, HTML, that sort of stuff. And something cool about SQLite is there's actually an app on the iPad called Draft Code that will allow you to write and develop in PHP and use SQLite databases right on the iPad. That's from freeridecoding.com. So there's a couple different options that you could play around with. If I were you, though, Joe, I'd probably start with trying out Tap Forms. I think they have a free trial available on their website. Don't quote me on that because I can't quite remember. But try that out and see if that works for you. And if you do and it works, let us know. Let us know your experience with it. And I look forward to hearing from you. And good luck. If you've listened to the show for any kind of period of time, you've likely heard me say that I think one of the best upgrades that you can do for your Mac is upgrading your RAM. So if you have 2 gigabytes going to 4, or even better yet, 8, you know, basically maxing out your RAM. And I fully realize that everybody probably does not share my opinion, which is why I wasn't surprised when I received this from John.
Hi, Adam. This is John from beautiful Palos Verdes, California. I'd like to provide a slightly different perspective on your discussion about storage and priorities for upgrades on last week's MacCast. I've always followed your hierarchy of priorities, putting RAM first, then SSDs, then processor upgrades. But recently I've learned to flip the first two, putting SSD first, and here's why. First, adding RAM has a point of diminishing returns. In 2012, I bought a 12-core Mac Pro and added 64 gigabits of RAM. First problem is it takes a full 30 seconds before the chime starts the boot process, since it has to check the viability of all that RAM every time it boots. Definitely a bummer. Second, even with all that processing power and RAM, when I compare time-consuming rendering tasks in Photoshop and programs like Nix plugins that take minutes, it's only about 20 to 30% faster on the Mac Pro compared to my 16 gigabits of RAM on a MacBook Pro Retina. As for SSD, the improvements are very noticeable. Mind-blowing, actually. I have a ton of software on my current late 2013 MacBook Pro Retina, yet the boot time with SSD is 33 seconds and shutdown time is 15 seconds. When I boot on the same computer from a clone backup on an external Thunderbolt drive, the boot time is a whopping 4 minutes 39 seconds, which is 8 times slower. For the hard drive, the shutdown time is 1 minute 30 seconds, which is 6 times slower. A clean version of OS X Mavericks without applications installed loads in 7 seconds on my SSD, which is truly awesome. RAM upgrades just don't deliver those kinds of performance advantages. As for processors, even for programs like Photoshop Creative Cloud that are written for the latest 64-bit processors, I'm rarely accessing even half of my 12 cores, even though the tasks are measured in minutes, not in seconds. So I would personally revise the pecking order to 1. SSD is my new top priority. 2. Upgrading RAM to 16 gigabits, but no more than that. And 3. Then dealing with the processor upgrades as a third priority. Anyway, that's my 2 cents. Hope that's helpful to some of your listeners. Keep up the great work. I've been a listener from the very beginning. I never cease to learn great tips from you and your show.
Hey, thanks, John. I really appreciate the feedback. And what it made me think is that I really need to clarify my position a bit. And hopefully I've been pretty clear about why I have my position. You were very clear about why you've changed your position. And I think it's relevant specifically for you and also for a specific segment of the audience. And there's where I need my clarification. Basically, my rules are very generalized and they assume some things. You know, the assumption is that I'm giving I hate to say one-size-fits-all solution, but a one-size-fits-most sort of solution. And I still think for overall performance, for the average user, more RAM is dollar for dollar the best bang for your buck. And that's another way I've often caveated this thing is, like, if you're going to spend money and you're on a tight budget, spending on RAM first is really the way to go. Because most Macs come with barely adequate RAM in the base models for the year the machine came out. There's really no headroom or longevity. So often when I'm talking about upgrades, I'm talking about how to get the most longevity out of your system and not break the bank. RAM is cheap compared to SSD, and that is true, very true, you know, today. So unless that changes, you're not going to beat RAM in terms of an upgrade. And I totally agree with you about the point of diminishing returns. 16 gigabytes is probably more RAM than most, or probably the right amount of RAM for most people, I guess I should say at this point. 8 to 16, I think, is kind of that sweet spot for most people, depending upon what your needs are. Anything above that is going to be debatable, I think, in terms of the incremental performance increase. So I guess there is kind of a stopping point, and maybe I should have been more clear about that in the past. The performance benchmark you're going for, though, is also going to be a factor. So again, generalizing, what I've found is most people who email me, what I'm going to call the quote-unquote average person, what they see as performance slowdowns are beach balls. They say, you know, why is my Mac running so slow? Why am I seeing all these beach balls when I'm processing stuff? And what I very commonly found is a lot of people like to have, like, every app open all the time, right? They don't do what I call dock management. I'm fanatic about it. I hate having a bunch of little white dots or blue dots on my dock. I'm constantly shutting down applications and freeing up RAM. But most people, my wife is in this group, I go sit down at her computer and every app on the dock is open. And that's going to be the kind of situation where you're going to lead to RAM getting used up and virtual memory kicking in. And that's when the beach balls and the slow Mac and that sort of thing starts to happen. So adding more RAM solves that kind of problem. The cool thing here with SSD, with your solution, is that if you do end up getting into a virtual memory scenario, I would assume, I have a MacBook Air with an SSD, but my day-to-day Mac still has a spindle drive. So I would assume, though, paging out to virtual memory on an SSD is much, much faster and probably not going to cause as many problems as it does with a spindle drive. So you get a little bonus there. Now, your benchmark was boot times and cold app launches, and there it's no contest. If that is your benchmark for performance, then SSD is going to win hands down every single time. But I personally, I don't shut my machines down. So a longer boot time, a longer startup time, or a longer shutdown time really doesn't impact my experience on a day-to-day basis. I guess if I was booting up my Mac every single day and having to wait that time period, adding an SSD would be a huge advantage to me, but I just don't run across that in my day-to-day uses. All this being said, let's face it, Apple is moving, and we are moving to a place where the SSD versus RAM argument might be completely moot. My guess is that in a year or two, you're not going to be able to buy a Mac that has a spinning drive in it. It's going to be all flash and SSD based. And also, RAM and flash storage on Macs is tending to trend toward that non-user upgradable point, which means that you're probably going to want to be able to max out both of those things at the time of purchase, depending upon your budget. But still, even in that future scenario, or even in a world where we can't upgrade the RAM, we can't upgrade the storage in our device, I think I'm still going to place RAM as the first thing to consider spending your dollars on, because you're not going to be able to upgrade it later, but you will be able to add on external storage, say an external SSD Thunderbolt drive later. So with a limited budget, you're prioritizing your dollars, RAM first, then if you have more left over, go for the SSD option. And of course, all of this is my opinion, and knowing how you in particular use your Macs, I totally agree with you flopping it, and I'm sure there's others out in the community that are in your same kind of boat. If you're all about startup times and launch times, and you're dealing with high load applications, things like Photoshop that might trigger paging and those sorts of things, those two things can, RAM plus SSD together can really benefit you in your upgrade path. So I hope that helps clarify things, and really thank you so much for sending in that audio comment, because it is a good thing to talk about. You have to go beyond just the sort of generalized one-size-fits-all scenario at a certain point and tailor it to meet your specific needs, which is exactly what you're doing. This next subject comes up from time to time on the show, although I have to admit, typically it involves trying to convert albums or cassette tapes. But this time around, Robert recently emailed me to say, hey, I found a bunch of these old reel-to-reel tapes, and I wanted to know about using my Mac to actually convert them to digital files, something that I can put into iTunes. And luckily, he has a reel-to-reel player already. He just needs to know, how do I connect this thing to my Mac, and how do I convert this analog stuff into a digital form? And Robert, the first thing you'll need to do is get some sort of analog to digital interface and the right cables to connect it to your tape player so that you can get the audio into your Mac in a digital format. And you may also want to connect everything up through an amplifier depending upon your source. So you might want to take the reel-to-reel, plug it into your amplifier, and then run your amplifier into the analog to digital converter, just in case you need to control the gain or the volume coming into your Mac. But luckily, there's a lot of simple analog to USB converter devices out there, and they should work. There's tons of different options. A couple of them that I like, one is the tried and true Griffin iMic. So you might be familiar with Griffin from their cases and accessories, things like that. They have a roughly $40 US product, $39.99 product called the Griffin iMic, and it has USB on one end, and then on the other end, eighth inch, your standard headphone eighth inch jack audio in and out connectors. So what you can do is just take a cable coming out of your reel-to-reel, plug it in to the Griffin iMic, plug that USB into your Mac, and that will convert the analog to a digital signal. Now, it worked through Mountain Lion according to the specs on Griffin's website. They don't specifically mention OS X Mavericks, but I would assume it would work. This is just it's a USB audio interface, basically, is what it's turning your reel-to-reel tape player into, and it's a tried-and-true product, worked forever, so you can check that one out. Another one that I found out about recently is the Behringer U-Control UCA202. That's $29.99, so a little less expensive, $30 US, and it has RCA audio in and out, as well as, connecting to USB for the digital audio. I should also mention both of these devices have onboard monitoring, so you can plug the headphones right into the digital audio interface, the little device, so that you can hear what you're recording as you're recording it. That's good because USB audio coming into the Mac will typically, if you're trying to monitor it, say inside GarageBand, it's going to have latency, so you're not going to hear it at the same time that it's playing through. With the Behringer U-Control, there's also a newer 222 model, and I guess that adds some DSP effects, but it also requires a proprietary driver, so that could potentially bring in some compatibility issues. So I would look at the UCA202. As a matter of fact, Tom Merritt recently picked this as a pick on the Mac show, the British Tech Network Mac show, which is how I know about it. I actually have an Eterol version that's very similar. So like I said, there's lots of these different devices. Basically, a USB audio converter is what you need. So you can do a little Google searching if you want to find some additional options. But once you have that running into your Mac, then all you need is an application that can see the USB audio as an input source and record it. And a great app that we all have access to, it's built in and free on the Mac, is GarageBand. There's also another free application called Audacity, which is an open source application, which is great for capturing and recording audio. So Both of these applications, GarageBand and Audacity, will allow you to layer on effects and filters and equalizers if you need to do a little cleaning up or enhancing of the audio coming in. But basically, you'll set up a new project, you'll set your levels and effects up, and then hit record in the application and hit play on your player or source, in your case, the reel-to-reel, and the audio will start coming in, and you record it, in essence, in real time, just like if you were doing a tape, you know, a tape dub back in the day. And then once you're done, all you have to do is export the audio file from GarageBand. Let's just use GarageBand in the example, and get it into the finished format that you want. Now, when you finish in GarageBand, what you're going to end up with is a .band file, a GarageBand project file. If you're using the new version of GarageBand or the older one, GarageBand 11 version 6.0.5, then you can just simply go under the share menu and choose the export song to disk option, and that will save out an AIFF version, a full quality, basically CD quality version of the file. With GarageBand 11, you have the added advantage. If you just go under the track menu and enable the podcast track, so just choose show podcast track under the track menu, when you go use the export to disk option, what you'll actually see is export podcast disk. And in picking that, when the export dialog comes up, you actually get some additional conversion options. So you can direct convert in the older version of GarageBand to MP3 or AAC, not just AIFF format. Unfortunately, in the new version, they removed all the podcasting features, and that ability to export directly to a different audio format was also removed or lost. So if you export to AIFF and you want to convert it to a different format, the easiest way to do that is probably to throw it into iTunes and then convert it there. So once it's in iTunes, what you can do is go under the iTunes preferences, and then in the general tab, you're going to want to click on the import settings button, and there you can select from the pop-up menu the type of file format that you actually want to convert the recording to, and click OK to save the settings. Then once you've done that, back in the iTunes library, just select the AIFF version of the file that you imported from the GarageBand export, and then choose File, Create New Version from the File menu, and then you can pick one of the, you can select the format that you had selected in the import preferences. So you change it there, and then you'll see the option under the Create New Version menu for Create MP3 or AAC or WAVE, whatever you picked when you set up those settings. And then it'll actually convert the file right inside iTunes, and you'll end up with both versions being inside iTunes. And then you can drag the converted track out, put it wherever you'd like, and you can also then delete any versions that you no longer want in iTunes. If your final destination is actually, say, an MP3 file in iTunes, then you can just leave the MP3 version there and then delete the original AIFF version out of iTunes. And that's pretty much it. It's a pretty straightforward process, and that's how you can convert that stuff. About the only other thing that I can think of is, in some cases, you may need to further clean up the audio. If you end up having a lot of hisses or hums or pops and scratches, stuff that's in the original audio that you can't sort of tweak out with the filters that are in GarageBand, you can actually process your AIFF files through an application called Sound Soap. It used to be made by Bias, which they no longer make. I don't think they're in business any longer, as a matter of fact. The Twit Studios, Leo Laporte's studios, are actually in their old building. But they made this great application called Sound Soap. It's been picked up by another company called Soundness LLC, and they have a version 3.0. It works as a standalone version in OS X Mavericks, and it works best if you can get about 10 to 15 seconds of the noise audio that you're trying to remove. But basically what it'll do is it'll select the noise that you're trying to get out of the audio track, and then it can almost pull it out automatically. It has manual dials and controls where you can kind of fine tune it, but it's a really neat application. I used it for a long time on the MacCast back in the early days, and that might be helpful for kind of cleaning up the audio a bit more. So hope that helps you out, and good luck with the reel-to-reel conversion. And then the last thing that I have for you today is something that I never get tired of. It never gets old for me. It's another AppleCare success story. This time around, it came from Mark.
Mark here from London. Just want to say once again a comment on the excellent Apple service we have. Last night I was using my new, now 2-month-old Retina iPad Mini at home on my desk in its case, and it slipped off the desk onto the carpeted floor, and lo and behold, managed to get some sort of weird flickering color line running across the screen. So I booked an appointment yesterday with the Apple Store here in Covent Garden for this afternoon. I went in this afternoon, he took one look at the iPad and goes, okay, and I did explain my story that it was my fault, it fell off the desk onto the floor. He says, not a problem, let's check the stock. And 10 minutes later, I walk out with a brand new Retina iPad Mini from the Genius Bar swap. And that was it, done in and out in about 15 minutes, including waiting time.
Hey, that is awesome, Mark. I'm so glad they took care of you. And, you know, I will often, after playing these, get an email from a person or two who says, you know, I had completely the opposite experience. You know, they did not take care of me. They did not meet my needs. And there's always stories that go both ways. But I have to say that more often than not with AppleCare and with Apple service, I hear your type of story versus the other one. You know, it's just one of those things. You never know what's going to happen on that day, how the person's going to be feeling, and it can sometimes seem unfair that one person gets this great, awesome service, and then you just happen to be the guy that came in that day and didn't get the same sort of treatment. But, you know, what you point out is good to be clear about, is that accidental damage is something that is not covered by Apple. But as I've always said, it never hurts to go in and ask, right? The worst case thing that's going to happen is they're going to tell you what it's going to cost to fix or replace the unit. And as I found out one time, it might not be as high as you're expecting. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes they can offer you an out-of-warranty replacement price rather than a full retail replacement price. So it might be a little bit less, and you might not realize, you know, hey, you might think one thing is broken and it's going to be very costly to repair. Come to find out after they look at it that it's not quite as costly. So again, always worth at least going in and trying, and you might have exactly the experience that you had, Mark. I had a friend who never owned a Mac product before. She was a Windows user, had been a Windows user her whole life. I think her husband was totally anti-Mac. And because she knew me, she was very interested in potentially using Macs. She used Macs at work and got to enjoy and like them, and decided, you know what, I'm going back to school, I want to get a MacBook. It was when they had the white and black MacBooks. And so she went to the Apple Store, she got her MacBook, and the very first night, she's setting it up less than 12 hours later, and she has a little toddler, and it was in her lap. The toddler came over, grabbed the screen, kind of pulled on it, and before she knew what was going on, it flipped over, landed on the floor, completely cracked the display, destroyed it. She came into work the next day completely distraught. She said, totally my fault. You know, I don't know what to do. What should I do? I said, you know what? Take it down to Apple. Show it to them. Tell them what happened. Let them know honestly what was going on and just see what they say. I said, they're probably going to want to charge you for a replacement screen. You're probably looking at $800 to $1,000, but just go in and see what they do. She went in, explained the whole thing, and they turned around and just replaced it for her. Said, we're really sorry. Enjoy your new MacBook. And guess what? They have a Mac owner for life because of that experience. That is going to pay back over and over and over again. And she tells everybody that story. And it's just good for business. So you never know. Go in. And like I said, I never get tired of hearing those stories. So if you have one of your own, good or bad, I like hearing them both ways. And I'm happy to play some of the the alternate experiences, shoot us an email and audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for today. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment, thank another couple of our show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Disk Label for Mac, as well as Text Expander for iOS, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. And also be sure to check out their new app, PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can shoot your feedback to maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave voicemail by calling on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you'd like to leave voicemail on Skype, my Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, and check out the MacCast Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you should find us there. I look forward to seeing you online, but until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.